Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called From Firefight to Fiction, an interview with military surgeon and author Dr. Jeffrey Wilson. So enough of my ranting and raving, it's time for your hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, thanks, John, and I want to welcome everybody to this episode of Crime and Science Radio. We have an excellent guest tonight, my dear friend, Dr. Jeff Wilson, friend and colleague, I should say. And Jeff is your classic underachiever. He's only worked as an actor, a firefighter, a paramedic, a jet pilot, a diving instructor, a naval officer, and, by the way, a vascular and trauma surgeon. He also did numerous tours of duty in Afghanistan as a combat surgeon for both the Marines and the Joint Special Operations Task Force. If that wasn't enough, he's gone on to write some fiction, Traitor's Ring and The Donors and his latest Fade to Black, and has won some awards for doing that. He's originally from Virginia, but now lives in the great state of Florida, where he still is a part-time vascular surgeon and a consultant with the Department of Defense, and is working on his next book, of course. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I like the way you say it, Doug. When my mom says it, she just says, "How come you can't keep one job?"
Moms are that way, aren't they?
Well, when Doug just gave that list of occupations, I thought, really, we should just do a two-part show, one about your life up to, and then go on from there. But so you've had a lot of jobs. You've been an actor, firefighter, paramedics, you mentioned, naval officer, pilot, all these various professions, all of them challenging. What led you to settle on vascular and trauma surgery as a career?
Well, of course, you're starting from the false assumption that I've settled on one career, but is probably a better question is how I ended up in surgery from medicine. I had been a paramedic in the past, and I was always drawn to medicine. I think as a young man, I always thought I might eventually go to medical school, but had some other hills I wanted to climb before that. But once I was in medical school, the decision to end up in surgery was not much of a decision. I think you guys know that there's certain personality types in certain professions, and my personality type just matched up with surgery pretty easily. It's, you know, kind of focused on the problem and fixing the problem and moving on. And, you know, the thought of managing an illness for 12 or 15 years wasn't as attractive to me as fixing something and sending them on their way initially, I think. When I was interviewing for surgery residencies, I'd been a pilot, and that would always came up in the interviews, and they're like, "Oh, you know, why would you leave being a jet pilot, and why do you want to be a surgeon?" And I was like, "Look, you take 100 pilots and 100 surgeons, and you put them in a room, give them cocktails, and don't let any of them talk about surgery or flying. I challenge you to figure out who's who." I mean, it's a personality type, you know, that you gravitate to a profession that sort of has the same personality type as yours, and I think that's how I ended up in surgery. Vascular surgery, I was fascinated with. It's very detail-oriented. It's very creative. You know, you kind of make things up. I think Doug can appreciate you sort of make things up a lot. Once every other week, you make something up you've never heard of before, which is cool. The trauma part is exciting and kind of adrenaline-driven. I sort of fell into that just because I was in the military. I didn't really plan on doing trauma until I got to Iraq. But, you know, so it's always a journey. Who knows what will be next? We'll see what I wind up actually settling for eventually.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking as I read about your bio, is that you can have the high pressure of vascular surgery or even trauma surgery, but hey, let's do it where we're in a combat situation. So so how did you end up getting into working in the military as a surgeon?
Yeah, you know, my life has been a lot about service. If you look at a lot of the professions on that list, they sort of are linked to service, whether it's to your community or to your city or your country in the military. And I think I've always gravitated to that. It might be a family thing. My dad was a military fighter pilot. My uncle was a Marine, and we've got a long history in my family of service. And I had served before. So before I went to medical school, I had been in the Navy briefly, and I had served in other aspects of government service for a period of time. And then when I went to medicine, I sort of thought that'd be the end of it. You know, I had this vision of becoming this academic vascular surgeon. My mentor, Dennis Bandick, who's out in California now, in San Diego, he was a real hero to me. He's very academic and very bright and does tons of research. And as I was coming up, I was like, that was my vision. I'll be that guy, you know. I'll be a professor, and I'll do research, and I'll teach. And I really wanted to do that. And unfortunately, in my chief year of my residency, just before I started my fellowship, they crashed a couple of planes into the towers and the Pentagon, mm-hmm. and it just kind of pissed me off, to be honest with you. At that point, I wasn't really planning on a military career. I was still a reservist, having been in the military before. And like probably 99.9% of Americans, I was just pissed. And so I went back on active duty, and next thing I knew, I was finishing my fellowship, and then I was in Virginia, and then I was in Iraq. And from there, I sort of snowballed into various different assignments that I very much enjoyed. But it was really more of a service thing. It wasn't a looking for the thrills or the rush. It just sort of, you know, circumstances happened in the world that drove me in that direction. I'm glad it did. It shaped who I was, shaped who I am now, both as a doctor and a writer. So I don't have any regrets. But, just sort of one of those things, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we have parallels that way. You know, internal medicine, I would have jumped off a building by now. Then that's what, you know, I graduated to cardiology is because you fix things right here, right now, and move on. And like you, I was planning on academic teaching, ivory tower, all that stuff, research. But somehow I just realized I'm not the guy that's going to sit all day looking at data.
Right.
I'd rather
no,
be
I
out
hear
the
you.
ER
I
and
absolutely
the, you know, and the ICUs and the cath lab and all that stuff. Well, most people, you know, medicine's a foreign arena to most people who don't dwell in that world and live there. And so even a hospital's a scary place, but and a very unknown place. But being in a war zone and having to do sophisticated surgical procedures, what was it like there? Give us a feel for what the facilities were. I mean, would you work in a hospital, a mass unit, a lean-to? I mean, you know, where did you ply your trade out there at the point of the spear?
You know, and in Iraq and in Afghanistan, they had every element that you've just described, from lean-to up to, you know, modern hospital. I never was in the modern hospital setting, other than passing through from point A to point B. But I will tell you, it's impressive what they have there, CAT scanners and interventional radiologists who are doing amazing endovascular procedures and neurosurgeons and all that. I was never part of that. You would think as a vascular surgeon I might have been at the time that I was over there. There were only 6 vascular surgeons in the Navy, so I sort of thought, oh, yeah, I'll be one of those vascular surgeons at the CASH. But when I reported for my first deployment with the Marines, they were looking for someone to volunteer to be with what's called a FRIS team. You may have heard of the Devil Docs. They're the small surgical units that go to the forward edge of the battlefield and set up these trauma receiving centers. And, you know, that seemed like a place where I could make a difference, and so I did that, which was more of a MASH type thing. You know, you had used the MASH analogy. It's certainly come a long way from Hawkeye Pierce, but
sure.
It's similar to that. You know, mobile now in the FRIS team setting truly is mobile. We traveled with the Marine all the way to the forward edge of the battlefield. We would set up an encampment with command and control co-located with medical. We had inflatable tents. We'd have a couple of surgeons, an anesthesia provider, and a handful of corpsmen, and we could do damage control surgery right there within a mile sometimes of the fight. And our recovery room would be a Black Hawk helicopter to CASEVAC them out to the next level of care. So that was more my element. I was a little jealous of those people that had the, you know, the big chow hall with the steak on Thursdays and all that stuff. My first deployment, we had two hot meals a day that were flown in from somewhere, and then a lot of MREs, not much in the way of fresh fruit and vegetables. So we were a little jealous of those guys when we passed through Fallujah and Al-Asad and some of the big bases. But what we did was amazing. We were able to get guys from the point of injury to the operating room in less than an hour, you know, almost like stateside. I mean, it was amazing how you could get these guys, stabilize them, get them into a helicopter and fly them out. And that makes a huge difference. I mean, the evolution from World War II through Vietnam and Korea and even Desert Storm and now, unbelievable. And part of that is getting the assets to the point of injury, and that's what the FRISS teams did. Once I left that, I wound up with Naval Special Warfare working with the SEAL teams, and that was a whole different thing. That made what I was doing before look pretty luxurious and comfy, much more austere and not a lot of equipment. But you'd be amazed what you can do. You can do amazing things with very little stuff if you have no choice. So,
yeah, necessity, invention.
There you go.
Let me ask you, how did you maintain sterility in that kind of environment when you're trying to work on someone in one of these pop-up units and out in the middle of nowhere? And was that a major problem, or was the system designed to handle that from jump street?
It was just sort of a blend of those two. So we certainly had our version of sterile technique. It does make me appreciate what we have here a little bit more. We didn't have running water, so we didn't have scrub sinks and that kind of thing. But you'd have a corpsman pouring sterile saline water on you while you scrubbed your hands. We still had, packets of gowns and gloves. But I can remember coming under attack before and having dust fall in the patient, and that's probably not very common at a level one trauma center stateside. But what's interesting to me is that if you look at the infection rates in that theater of operations, maybe not in special warfare, but with the Marines and the conventional forces, the infection rates not considerably higher than what you see stateside. I mean, if you have a little attention to detail and you're pretty liberal with irrigation and washing things out and packing them off, it's not a huge difference. It felt filthy, but it turns out it probably wasn't as bad as it felt.
Well, what were the typical injuries and types of things that you dealt with in the unit there? What kinds of things did you see frequently?
Yeah, it depends on the deployment. I've done multiple deployments, like I said, with the Marines and then with special warfare. That would be a whole different thing. It's interesting, the evolution of the injuries is less related to the bad guys and what their weapons are than they are to the good guys and the kind of protective gear they have. You see the guys on TV now all kitted up, and they've got this body armor on that is light years beyond what we had in Vietnam. Those guys were wearing a pretty simple ballistic vest like you see a police officer in. And when you see a Marine kitted up, he's got this amazing system of body armor that protects his torso all the way down through his pelvis and his groins, even his shoulders and his neck. And that body armor will withstand even a high-velocity round. And so the injury patterns we were seeing was a lot less of the cavitary injuries. You didn't see a lot of chest injuries. You didn't see abdominal injuries. If you saw that, those guys were screwed, because if you had a blast injury that was bad enough to penetrate through your gear, you had a lot worse problems than just that. So we saw a lot of vascular injuries, which as a vascular surgeon was perfect for me, right? You'd see femoral artery injuries and brachial artery injuries. We saw a lot of extremity injuries. The orthopedists were extremely busy. But much less of the penetrating chest and abdomen and pelvis trauma than in conflicts in the past, much less.
Well, you talked earlier about having to think on your feet and create things and all that. Were there any situations that you remember distinctly that where you had to step outside the box of your comfort zone and do things that you thought, well, surely somebody's done this before, but I've never done it before. And let me just kind of think, how would I do this, that kind of situation?
Right. you know, it was in terms of the way you actually manage the trauma, you know, at the risk of being self-depreciating, trauma surgery is not a genius specialty. I mean, if it's got a hole in it, you plug it. If it's bleeding, you stop it. If it won't stop bleeding, you remove it. I mean, and so a lot of those principles are the same, whether it's a 22 caliber round in a civilian trauma center or a, you know, AK-47 7.65 round in Iraq. The pattern of injury might be more devastating, but when you're down inside the patient, it's sort of the same principles. I'll be honest with you, Doug, the thing that made it more challenging was not that. What made it more memorable, what made it more challenging was the intimacy of it. And what I mean by that is in a stateside trauma center, and I know that there's a lot of great people that have horrific injuries, but you've been in a level one trauma center, and 75 or more percent of your patients, they're in some way culpable for why they're there. They were, you know, shit-faced,
yeah,
drunk and wrapped their car.
Yeah.
They were
drunk,
shot a cop and
the
then
phone,
got shot,
yeah,
in return. These guys are young, brave American men, 20, 21, 22 years old, out doing the right thing for the right reasons. And they're your brothers. They're your brethren. There's the good guys and the bad guys. It's cowboys and Indians. And it is intimate. And I think that's what makes it challenging. It's not that the pattern of injury is so difficult to do. It's that, gosh, this is just some kid. This is some Marine who's out here for the right reasons. And when I went over to Naval Special Warfare, that was even worse, because then it was truly a brotherhood, and it's a guy that you live with. It's a guy that you eat meals with and you know, deploy with, and you know his wife and his kids. I mean, it's a very, very small, close-knit community. And so that was the challenge. It was the intimacy of the injuries and the patients that force you to work a little differently, not as much the patterns of injuries. Obviously, the multiple traumas, the mass casualties, I mean, there's certainly stories to tell of creative things that you have to do. But that's what I, you know, when I think back on it, I don't think about a particular case without thinking about the person and how intimate it was and how emotional it was to take care of a young Marine. And on the bench, you know, on the bed next to him was the Al-Qaeda operative that shot him in the throat, and you're supposed to take care of him too. I mean, those are the things that made it challenging to me more than the medical aspects.
Wow.
So when you were serving in either place, were there times when you were under fire while in surgery?
Well, again, on the special warfare side, it's a whole different thing. You're always under fire. But when I was with the Frist team and with the Marines, there were a couple of times. I was at a, you know, you generally went out with the Marines was the idea, and then you'd be at the forward edge of the battlefield. But in reality, we were set up in a very small forward operating base called Korean Village. It was way out near a little village called Arupa, which is sort of the highway, at the fork of the highway that goes from Baghdad and Fallujah towards Syria and Jordan. And it was in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they said it was the Wild West. There was nothing there. And when we talk about bases there, it's not like Langley Air Force Base. It's like, you know, a Walmart parking lot with some pop-up tents, and that's about it. And we actually wound up doing most of the medical care we did there. That was our base, and from there we were supposed to leave, go outside the wire in our Humvees and set up with the Marines. But most of the operations they were doing in 2005 and 2006 in that area were taking convoys out and doing show of force patrols in various villages, and they would get hit, and then they would come back to this base. So we were co-located with a shock trauma platoon in this little tiny forward operating base. And there were a couple of times when the base came under fire. I was out jogging once, and a rocket came in, and that was kind of scary. The only time I remember in that deployment when we were doing surgery, I actually had a kid that had a convoy got hit by an IED. This kid had a blast injury under his clavicle, and I used to carry this little ultrasound machine around with me, and I could see that he had this expanding pseudoaneurysm in his subclavian artery right under his collarbone. And anywhere else you might say, well, this isn't the best place to operate on that. Let's send him to the level one trauma center. But here you're going to put him in a blacked-out helicopter with a couple of corpsmen for an hour to get him to the next level of care. If he blows that thing out in flight, it's bad. So we elected to fix it, and so I harvested some saphenous vein and I got up under the clavicle, and just as I put my clamps on, the bad guys decided that was a great time to attack our camp and try to overwhelm us. So the Marines were fighting them, and just as I put the clamps on, they hit our generator. We lost all of our electricity. I've got a couple of corpsmen holding flashlights while we're trying to sew this bypass graft in. It sounds like something from a movie. It was really one of those things where at the time you're like laughing because, I mean, what the hell else are you going to do? You're laughing. There was my anesthesia guy and a guy named Jim who, in the middle of the case, right after that happened, he had one of the corpsmen watching his stuff, and he left for a couple minutes. Like, where in the hell would he go? I'm like, I'm in the middle of sewing this thing in. What is he doing? And he comes back, and he's got his shoulder holster on with his 9-millimeter pistol. And I'm thinking, okay, we're safe now because the anesthesiologist now has a pistol. So now everything is going to be okay. What could possibly go wrong now?
We're covered.
You know, you laugh or else you would cry. But that's the only one I remember that was like that.
You know, Doug tells me that he has heard of cases of the patients having unexploded devices embedded in them. Did you ever come across anything like that?
I would love to tell you that that's folklore legend, but it's not. I have never been involved in a case like that, but that case that was in a lot of the medical journals is a real case, and it happened actually during my deployment. I was in the middle of nowhere, so they had never sent that to me. But it went to the cache, to the upper level trauma center. And I will tell you, I wish I could remember his name because he deserves to be recognized publicly on the radio. But this surgeon volunteered to be the one to remove this unexploded ordnance. Basically, it was a rocket propelled grenade,
right,
that hit a soldier in the side. Right at the point in his body armor where it separates, and it went into his abdomen, lodged partly in his pelvis, and the surgeon and a couple of EOD guys were in the operating room and nobody else, and they did remove this thing, and the EOD guys took it out back, and it was a live ordnance. They actually detonated it, and it exploded, and, you know, the grace of God and some steady hands, they got that thing out, and the surgeon and the soldier both did fine. But yeah, amazing story. I don't know if I could have done that. I'm not going to lie to you. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's you know, so many times, you know, the things that you hear people doing, as you were saying earlier, for their brothers, you know, in these situations, it just is amazing. So what are the characteristics that you believe a good combat surgeon must possess?
Oh, geez. There's certain things that any good surgeon should possess, and I think maybe that's just magnified in that situation. Like, I think a good surgeon is not arrogant but confident, able to think quickly, especially in trauma and in vascular and cardiothoracic things where things can change very quickly, and when they do, it's not usually for the good. You need to be able to think quickly on your feet, make a quick decision, and have the confidence to move forward. Like, you can't ruminate. My dad, who's an old fighter pilot, used to say, look, it's okay to be mistaken, but you can't be in doubt. And I think surgeons in that setting kind of need to be like that. Sometimes mistaken, but never in doubt. Make a decision, move forward. If things change, move forward again. And I think that's true of all surgeons, but when you put it in a combat environment where you have very limited amount of resources, you have very limited support, your recovery room is a helicopter, so you have no feedback, you better be right because this guy's going to be flying in blacked out conditions for an hour. I think those things become more important. But, you know, other than that, you just need a good, solid cutter who's there for the right reasons and, you know, hope for the best, I guess.
I think it's a great point. I remember when I was a cardiology fellow down in Houston, we had a student come down, and he was from Chicago, and he was deciding what to do for his internship next year and which services to take. And he wasn't sure whether he should take ER or not. And I said, you want to be a real doctor? Do a couple of months in an ER at a major trauma center, because after that, nothing will scare you.
There you go.
And you can't be scared and be a doctor.
You'd be scared later.
We're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some of your fiction and get into that world.
Sounds great.
Today's show is called From Firefights to Fiction, an interview with military surgeon and author, Dr. Jeffrey Wilson. So again, without any further ado, here's your host, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back to the show. We're having a great discussion here with Jeff, who obviously has a lot of experience and a lot of experiences. But somewhere along the line, as if he didn't have enough to do, the fiction writing bug kind of crawled into his ear like an earwig and infiltrated his brain, and he decided to join this mad profession. When and how did you get involved in writing stories rather than living them?
You know, what's funny, Doug, is for me it was kind of just the opposite. Like, I've been a little schizophrenic over my many decades on the planet doing various things, and the one constant for me has sort of been writing. You know, I think I started writing little books when I was in elementary school, and pictures and stories, and I can remember, now I'm really dating myself, but I can remember being in elementary school and coming up with new episodes of Star Trek and writing those stories out and that kind of thing. And I wrote a short story when I was 13 or so and published my first short story at 14 in a kind of a regional thing for kids. And I remember that story even today. It was a kind of a supernatural weird thing. So I've always written. Like, that's been the one thread that pulls through everything. So maybe it was more that something inside me said, look, if you're going to write well, you're going to have to go do some stuff. You're going to have to start doing some things that will inspire your writing. So it wasn't really that I came to writing as much as I've always written sort of in the background. And then maybe 10 years ago or so, I'd never imagined I had the attention span to write a novel, right? Like, I write a short story in a night, and I can't imagine, like, the next night writing that same crap. Like, come on, I got a new idea now. But I had this idea for a short story that just seemed too complicated for a short story. And it got longer and longer. And next thing you knew, I was like, oh, my God, I surprised myself and wrote a book. And it's actually it was the first book I wrote. It was actually the third book that came out. It's my book that I have out now called Fade to Black. And from that I learned, writing a novel is way easier than writing a short story. There's no one saying you have a 5,000-word limit and you got to cram all your character development into the 2,500 words or whatever. It's like you can just write and write and write and develop and develop and develop. And I found I liked it a lot better and it was a lot more fun. And from that, more ideas came. So I don't think I gravitated to writing from life experience. It was sort of always there for me.
Cool. Do you use... you know, your experiences and your writing and your stories, your trauma surgery, your military surgery in your stories, and if so, what kind of things did you include in some of your stories?
You know, you and I talked a little bit about that in New York once, and I still am not sure really the answer. I mean, I guess everybody that writes puts their experiences into it at some point. You know, you read a story by one of your favorite writers, and there'll be that one character that is so real and so deep and rich and alive for you that you're like, okay, that's the one that he definitely modeled after somebody. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
And so for sure, my characterization comes from that rich tapestry of life experiences and bizarre personalities I've worked with. There's a lot of combined people in some of my characters. And in terms of the stories, you know, the three books I have out now are wildly supernatural elements. So those are obviously not grounded in reality, but the settings are. You know, my book, The Donors, was set in a hospital. And I think that whether you're a practitioner or a patient, everyone can appreciate that eerie, spooky feeling at 2 a.m. of walking through a dark hospital. Now, a hospital is such a... it's a place where you feel so vulnerable anyway, for sure as a patient. You know, you don't know what the hell is going on. Everything is in Latin. You don't know what the doctor's talking about. He's in a hurry. It's scary. And to build on that fear is pretty easy to do, and I did that in The Donors. And so to that extent, most certainly, I was able to play up some of my medical experiences. The Traitor's Ring and now Fade to Black are very heavy military themes, with some medical elements as well. So I wouldn't say that there's a specific story that happened exactly as it's in a book, but most certainly it's heavily, heavily influenced by things that have happened.
Well, tell us a little more about your novels and especially your latest book and what that's about.
Sure. The book that is out now is, well, they're all still out, but my most recent novel is called Fade to Black. Like I said, I was lucky enough to, I'm that lucky guy that I've written three books and they've all been published so far. So I'm very, very lucky, very blessed that happened. But this book happened to be the first book I wrote, and the third book I wrote was the first book that came out. I had a three-book deal with Journalstone. And they loved my third book and then bought the other two. But Fade to Black, I think, sort of evolved out of my fear of what would happen to me in Iraq if something didn't go well. At the time, I was a single dad to a young son who was 5, and I went away for 6 or 7 months into a pretty dangerous area. And my only real fear was not of getting hurt or even of getting killed, but what would happen to my son if I didn't make it back. And that sort of is where Fade to Black came from. Fade to Black is a story of a young Marine involved in the Battle of Fallujah. He's trying to lead his small squad of men through a firefight across a street. A couple of his guys get killed. He takes a round in the chest. He's laying there bleeding in the dusty streets of Fallujah. When he suddenly wakes up, and he is a school teacher in the middle America with a wife and a beautiful daughter at home. And the book progresses from there, where he's sort of torn back and forth between these two realities, thinking he's losing his mind and he's not sure which one is real. And then a very heavy supernatural element comes where some of his dead Marine buddies start convincing him, hey, you ought to be over here in this reality. And it goes from there. But it's definitely the underlying theme is that sense of fear what happens to your family if something bad happens to you in war.
You know, I think something you mentioned earlier that happens, having, you know, written supernatural stuff myself, is that it may be supernatural, but to engage the reader, you'd better hook into something emotionally real for them, if nothing else. So it really sounds like you've got that going in that book. So
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think that the real challenge is to make characters so, not just so real, but so empathetic to your reader. Like, you want your reader to love your character so much that when you start to introduce that really crazy-ass stuff,
mm-hmm.
they are forced to believe it, because if they don't, they have to stop believing in the character. You know what I mean? And so that's how I try to do it. I try to make the characters so empathetic and real that they'll accept some bizarre supernatural thing, because to not would be to dismiss this person they've fallen in love with.
Right.
But I agree with you. The supernatural is challenging for that reason. You have to give them something to hold on to that's real enough to pull them through. But on the flip side of that, it's a little bit liberating too. Like, you know, you're only limited by your imagination and your ability to make the characters real. And after that, kind of all bets are off and you can go wherever you want. And you can really develop characters in that setting too, because you can take a guy that he doesn't even know how he would be outside of his job at Walmart, but now all of a sudden he's dealing with, you know, the ghost of his grandmother who's asking him to come to some strange village. Well, I don't know how I'd act in that, you know, and so you can put them in these extreme situations and really see where they go. It's a lot of fun. It really is.
Right. You know, well, I think in some way, too, that all of us have unexpected things come our way in our lives, or situations that we have to deal with that we're saying to ourselves, you know, they didn't teach me this when I was getting my bachelor's degree in history or whatever, but what have I got in myself to call on in this situation? So
yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that's really insightful. You can tell you write supernatural stuff, because mm-hmm. a lot of the supernatural fiction, the good not the, you know, just chop up, you know, Frank Gore horror stuff, but the really good titillating supernatural stuff, it works because it's like an analogy, right? It's an analogy mm-hmm. for how unpredictable life is. You make it a little more extreme with your supernatural element, but people relate to it because they didn't expect their mom to die when they were only
right.
15, or they didn't expect this to happen or that to happen or some tragedy. And so they relate to it on some level because it's analogous to how unpredictable life is. And it makes it fun to write and hopefully fun to read.
Right. Well, you've got me completely intrigued about Fade to Black. So what about what you're working on next? What's coming up from here?
Well, you know, it was weird because I sort of wrote and wrote and wrote, and then my third book came out as my first book. I had the luxury of, like, really starting to build up some new stuff, and it sort of came in waves. So Fade to Black came out last year, and right now I have three works that I've recently finished over the last year and a half. And I'm really blessed that Gina Panetti Arias decided to represent me from Talcott Notch, and she's got a lot of negotiations going on for the three books I have out right now, and they're all very different. One is called Julian's Numbers. It's sort of a lot like my other books in that it's takes a very character-driven story and throws in some supernatural elements. It's called Julian's Numbers, but it's very hard to write because the main character is 10, and writing a book from a 10-year-old point of view was way more challenging than I thought it would be. You know, I've read a couple of Stephen King books where they've done that, and it's like, he made it look so easy. Wow, it's challenging. Now, if I wasn't a dad, there's no way I could have done it. There was enough stuff that I could sort of cling to as I did it. But that book was a lot of fun. And then I have a book called War Torn, which is military again, but how would I describe it? I guess it's a faith-based thriller. It's not got any supernatural elements, but it's about a Marine who gives his life to God just before he gets to Afghanistan, and then his best friend, who is sort of his mentor in his new faith, is killed in a attack, and it shakes his faith, and that, as he comes home, shakes his family's faith, and might even be more of a family drama from that perspective. And then the last book, the one I'm most excited about right now, is the first book in a series. It's tentatively entitled Tier 1, and it is not in any way supernatural. It's a straight-up military covert ops kind of thriller. And I am so lucky that I have written this book, because I wrote it with a friend of mine who Doug knows. His name is Brian Andrews. Wrote a brilliant book, techno thriller, called Calypso Directive. One of my favorite thrillers I've ever written. And he and I became friends, and he approached me a year and a half ago and said, hey, what do you think about writing a book together? He's a former naval submarine officer, and he is this rich research, plot, detail guy. And if you've read my stuff, I'm not. I'm this character, you know, plot, emotion guy. And but he knew that I had worked with Naval Special Warfare, and he wanted this SEAL kind of element in the book, and he had this idea, and he said, what do you think? And I immediately told him, no way in hell I am doing that. I could no more write with somebody. There's no chance I'm doing that. And he wore me down. After a couple of phone calls, he said, look, I'll make you a deal. We'll start, we'll outline it, we'll write a couple chapters. If it's not working for you, you get the story and you can have it. I was like, well, I'm not an idiot. I'll do that. And if I have nothing else going on, I write a book in, 9 to 12 months. And we wrote this book in, 16 weeks. And I love it. It's like one of the best things that either of us has ever written. So that was the first book in the series. It looks like we're very close to a final deal on that one. And we've already started on book two in the series, but we're really, really excited about it.
Sounds great.
You don't want to stay in one genre, right? Because then you could make a living.
Exactly. Oh, perish the thought. Well, in your reading and writing and rummaging around with writers and various commerce and stuff, what do you wish that writers really understood about members of the military and veterans and stuff, other than the usual stuff that you see on TV? What do you really wish that people understood about you and people like you?
Yeah, I love that question, because that's like one of, like everybody, you know, like you're a cardiologist, and when you see really bad medicine on a show or in a book, it really annoys you, right? And I'm that way with medicine and with the military stuff too. And there's a lot of it. I think the thing that bothers me the most in the portrayal of military action in thrillers is when it's trite. You know, obviously the detail stuff bothers you a little bit, but you get over that. Like, oh, Army doesn't do that. That's what Navy does, or whatever. Those things are annoying but tolerable, and I understand they just don't get it. Well, the things that bother me are when they make the characters trite, when they either make them the superheroes or they make them the, PTSD psychos or whatever. When they make the characters trite, that bothers me a lot. I think that the thing that's amazing about the military and the veterans that I try to incorporate into my books is how ordinary they are. These are ordinary people that do extraordinary things, and that's why I love them so much and I incorporate them into so much of my writing, is that they are fathers and husbands and brothers and sisters and friends. And, you know, they come home from a six-month deployment with the Navy SEALs in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Djibouti, and then they cut the grass and they pick up milk because we need some, and they get their kids to school. And their life outside of the extraordinary things they do are ordinary. And that's what makes them so relatable if you write it well. Because now people really care about them. They don't care about them. They love the story. They love the action. But they don't really love your characters unless you make them relatable. And that's what's so amazing, is they are relatable. They're your neighbor. They're the guy that 2 years ago was graduating from high school and always wanted to be in the Army. I mean, they're everyday people. And it bothers me when they're made trite in thrillers. And it's very common. Happens all the time.
Well, I have to interject here a little shout-out to my buddy Jeff Parker. T. Jefferson Parker's new book is called Full Measure. I'm reading it right now. I'm about 75% through it, and it is a departure for him. Of course, Jeff is a wonderful writer, but, he writes crime fiction. But this is a mainstream literary novel, and it revolves around these two brothers, one of which is just back from the military and all the stuff you went through, and both of them are troubled with PTSD. But he has rendered it so well, and he has created such a compelling story for the exact reasons that you said. So if you haven't read it, do, and anybody out there listening, do. It's a wonderful book.
Oh, I definitely will.
It's really well done.
Brad Taylor is another good example of someone that, and again, he's got the background, which is
exactly
why, but he writes military action with realism for the technical stuff, but also from the characters. You know, the people are real, and I think that makes it, it just makes it so much more fun. You, as a reader, you may not even know why you like it better, but that's probably why.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what research tips would you offer to writers who have not served in the military, but who want to create characters in the military or characters who are veterans? What should people do? Where should they look to get good information?
Well, there's a couple ways you do it. One is to spend some time with some folks that are in the military or veterans, you know, which seems like common sense, but nobody seems to ever do. Like, it isn't hard to find these people. They're, especially now, you know, over a decade into a couple fronts of these wars, they're certainly everywhere. You know, volunteer at the VA and hang out a little bit with those guys and get to know these people. Donate books to the military and meet with some of those guys. Participate in ITW's USO when we were doing it. There's lots of ways to find these people. Another good way to do it is to read some of the good nonfiction. I wish I had anticipated this, and I could have given you a list, and maybe I'll send it to you. You can put it on the website. But there are some good nonfiction books that are written by people who have a real literary flair, and they're writing about real people in a very rich, characterized way that I think is helpful. Fiction writers that, like we've mentioned here, read some of those books and see how do they portray their characters. And then, quite honestly, the easiest way is pick people you know and imagine them in those extreme situations, and you're probably going to be pretty damn close to how it is. Because, again, these people are your neighbors. They're ordinary husbands and brothers and sons that are doing extraordinary things. And if you just take ordinary people that you know and put them in those situations and characterize them that way, you'll come pretty close. You'll come pretty close most of the time.
Well, one of the things that writers always want to know, because, I mean, they ask me a lot of questions, and they want to know what's state of the art and what's coming and all of that. And you mentioned earlier about how combat surgery had changed over the last, you know, few decades, and just even in the last decade how it had changed so much. And I know with artificial blood and with all the new bandages and the new coagulants and the different things that research has brought to the arena, what do you see the biggest need, or what do you see the future? What would you predict would be the next big step, if you know? Military combat surgery. What deficiencies do you see need to be corrected, or what techniques or what materials do you think would evolve? I mean, like, you know, we blood was always a problem, of course. And now
right,
we got artificial blood, and we got things that are much easier to transport, store, and use as a bridge to get someone from point A to point B alive.
Blood and procoagulants are two very hot areas of military research that have evolved almost logarithmically in the last decade. You know, like you said, it wasn't that long ago that it was blood or it wasn't blood. Like, you had Hespan, you know, you could give colloid or you can give blood. And now we're not there yet, but there are some very promising blood substitutes on the horizon that I think are going to be great. There's a few out there now that are good but not great, and I think that's an exciting area. The procoagulants are also very exciting. You know, we had QuikClot a decade ago, and now QuikClot looks sort of like leeches, you know, in my opinion. No offense to QuikClot people. It's still out there. It's great stuff. But they have come up with incredible new dressings that, you know, really target what you want and work the way you want it to do. But I think the most amazing thing that has happened in the last decade is the realization that you do not have to have a physician for some of this invasive stuff, that some of these kids, especially in special warfare and special operations in the Army, you take a SEAL medic, an 18 Delta medic, and there isn't too damn much you can't teach him to do. And you can sort of expand logarithmically your reach as a physician if you are working with a dozen SEAL medics that can take some of what you've learned into the field beyond where you're capable of being. And I think that's an area. I think you're going to see even more growth in the area of what these combat medics are able to do. You look at what they do now compared to Vietnam, and it's like the Ice Age versus the future.
Oh, sure.
And I think that you're going to see the next evolution is going to be some robotic stuff. You're going to see an explosion of handheld electronic devices that can transmit information in real time between a provider at the rear that can give them guidance, you know, downrange. I mean, I think that's the future, is some of that electronic stuff, whether it's robotic or information transmission to medics at the scene. It's amazing what's happened just in the last decade, but I think that's probably mostly the future.
Very good.
And then all that stuff we haven't imagined yet, right?
Exactly. But you, I think that the character that you just mentioned, the non-physician in the combat situation, I think that would be a great character for a story.
Yeah.
That guy.
Yeah, you should read The Traitor's Ring. I think there's a guy like that in there.
Yeah.
Well, I also think one of the things that we can do as writers are to make people think about things that might make them uncomfortable otherwise, and I think one of the biggest things, challenges we're facing in the country right now is providing care for people who've come back home. So, yeah, I think there are also some fiction possibilities there, because you kind of mentioned this earlier, there are things that people are surviving now in combat that it was unimaginable they would have survived them, you know, even, say, in Desert Storm, let alone
Vietnam. Oh, absolutely.
Vietnam.
Absolutely. There's no question. And there's, I couldn't agree with you more that there's not enough of awareness of that. And nonfiction, obviously a great way to do that, but fiction is a relatively untapped resource for spreading that message, too. The challenge is to write a great story that transmits that information without being preachy and ruining your story. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
And not very many people do it well. It's one or the other. Either the message didn't transmit, or it's so heavy-handed that you're like, oh, dude, I get it. You want me to take care of the veterans? Okay.
I think that's a good thing, though, for us, since a lot of our audience are writers, is to talk about it, which is that you find that balance between readers love information, but, you know, the old, if you want to send a message, call Western Union. That's true, you know, too, you have to not watch what you're sacrificing your story to in there.
Well,
and
the way you do it, I think, is you find your message and you wrap it in your relatable character, right? You make him real, because he's a real person with some of those real problems. Give him some of those real problems and some of those potential solutions as a backdrop for your story instead of as a preachy message. And I think that's the way you do it, you know, because then they care. They care because they like that guy or they like that gal, you know, whoever the character is, they relate to him. They want them to be okay, and you can spread awareness that way, I think.
Yeah, I think that's it's been about 14 years ago now, but that I had a book come out with an amputee, and I remember when I was first telling people that I was doing that, how many of my fellow writers went, oh, crimey, you know, nobody wants to hear about that, you know. I'm thinking, you know, I can't tell you how many letters I've had about people loving him. You know, will he be back on his own? Will he have his own, you know, books and stories? So, you know, you're right. It's really the who, because we're interested in stories about each other, you know, more than anything. The technology is going to change even the problems to some extent. The individual is another story.
And that's a question that comes up a lot in writers' conferences and just sitting around BSing with writers about, you know, how much information, how much is too much and how much is too little. And too many books are built around some cool science or some cool deal. And my response is always, remember, the story is not about the science. It's about the effect of the science or the milieu that the science creates on the people. Don't ignore the people. It's just people. And whether if they're a kindergarten teacher or a combat surgeon, they've got issues. And they got a problem. And that's what we want to read about.
Well, I don't have any issues, Doug. I'm just letting
you know. No, you got none.
Jeff, it has been so great talking to you. Thank you also for your service, and really, really have loved this interview.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you, guys. I enjoyed talking to both of you.
And send the links. And as everyone knows, this will be up on all the different websites, the crimeandscienceradio.com and on Suspense Radio. And you can connect to the show even in the archives later if you want to listen to it again later. And there will be a lot of links on my website, the Crime and Science Radio, right, Suspense Radio, where you can go for further study on all these issues. Jeff, thanks. Fantastic.
Thanks, Doug. I appreciate it. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.